A man who was probably closer to the national security wing of the conservative movement was Alexander Haig. The former Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan died today at age 85. NPR senior news analyst Daniel Schorr remembers a moment in Haig's career that may go down in history as the most important one.
If he's remembered for nothing else, General Al Haig has carved out his place in history as the one who negotiated President Nixon's peaceful exit from the White House. In the stormy climax of Watergate, with impeachment looming, Haig, who was Nixon's chief of staff, had a closed-door meeting with Vice President Ford. He warned that Nixon might throw the country into turmoil, might even pardon himself, along with all the Watergate defendants. Or Nixon could resign and be pardoned by his successor. Ford asked how far the president's pardon power went, and Haig produced a legal memorandum indicating that the president could issue a pardon at any time, even before any criminal action had been undertaken. Ford said he needed to talk to his lawyers and to his wife. He seemed to be aware that he faced a momentous decision. If he agreed to the pardon, he might be perceived as making a deal for the presidency. Eventually, he told Haig that he could not give an answer, given the delicacy of the situation, and Haig indicated that he understood. And that was enough of a commitment to permit Haig to assure Nixon that he could count on an early pardon, which in fact came within weeks of Nixon's resignation. Was there a deal, the presidency, for a pardon? Before a congressional committee, President Ford said emphatically, "There was no deal." But Al Haig had reason to congratulate himself on having saved the country from the tumult of an impeachment struggle. This is Daniel Schorr.
This morning, when you woke up, if you shaved or showered or put on makeup, any of the things you do on a normal morning, the chances are pretty high that by the time you're done, you've applied about 150 synthetic chemicals to your body. So what does that mean? Hard to say. So two Canadian environmental activists decided to spend 2 years exposing themselves to things we use all the time. Brand name shampoos, kitchen cleaners, toys, even foods. Rick Smith and Bruce Laurie tracked the levels of toxic chemicals in their bodies after using these things, and they tell the story in their new book, Slow Death by Rubber Duck. Rick Smith joins me from Toronto. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You describe this book as an adult science fair project, and I should say you weren't taking baths in mercury or just eating canned tuna for 2 years. I mean, you did the things that ordinary people do on a daily basis.
Absolutely. We established one cardinal rule of our testing. As we worked with scientists around the world to design these tests, the one rule we always had in mind was that our experiments had to mimic everyday life because, you know, obviously it'd be very easy to dramatically increase your Teflon levels if you were willing to drink some Teflon, but nobody does that. It wouldn't have any applicability to daily life.
I want to ask you about the experiments you did with BPA, because this is a chemical we often hear about. It's widely used in plastics. It's something most of us come into contact with every day, and yet it acts as a hormone in the body. Explain what you did and what you found.
Well, the test was really a simple one. My mother always told me not to microwave in plastic. She turned out to be very right. What I did for 48 hours is I simply ate canned food warmed up in a microwavable plastic container. BPA lines the interior of most cans in our cupboards, so that is a significant source of BPA in our daily lives. And then I drank out of one of my son's old BPA baby bottles. So, you know, after only 48 hours, my levels increased by almost 8 times. You can only imagine what the levels in an infant would look like if after 2 or 3 years of their sole source of nutrition being a BPA baby bottle, their levels would just be through the roof.
Mm-hmm. BPA has been banned in products for babies and infants in Canada. Several states in the United States are also doing that or have done that. Explain what BPA has been linked to.
Well, it was first synthesized in the 1930s, and we knew back then that it was a potent hormone-disrupting chemical. So it's been linked to prostate cancer, breast cancer, various hormonally-driven human ailments like obesity, diabetes. Even very low levels can be of concern, especially for children. Their cells are dividing, their brains and their organs are growing. All of these processes in childhood development are hormonally driven.
You have a chapter titled The New PCBs, and you talk about phthalates, which is a chemical compound often used in flame retardants for things like carpets, pajamas for kids, and so on. You talk about a typical day for your kids and the chemicals that they're just exposed to simply by walking from room to room in the house. What did you find?
Well, phthalates are another chemical of real concern. This chemical is ubiquitous in our lives. This is the chemical, for instance, that makes rubber ducks rubbery. And all I did with my self-experimentation is I used about a half dozen brand-name, off-the-shelf products containing phthalates, shampoos, soaps. And over a two-day period, my levels of this chemical increased by 22 times. So the upshot of this is that even when people are doing something as simple as showering, shaving, using air fresheners, they are dramatically changing their internal chemical levels.
Rick Smith, I understand that obviously you want to bring to light some of these issues. I mean, you talk about the linkage between these chemicals and an increase in birth defects, childhood autism, attention deficit disorder, rising cancer rates, and so on. But I wonder if there's an element of alarmism here in the sense that none of those linkages have been definitively proven scientifically yet.
Well, if you actually look at, and we spend a considerable amount of time in the book talking to the world experts in these areas, and on many of these chemicals, the verdict is in, with phthalates, for instance.
But, I mean, if the verdict is in, why are these things so widely used here in the United States, in Canada, and in Europe?
Because the chemical industry has been very effective in its lobbying of government regulators. I mean, the Milwaukee Journal, for instance, has done a very interesting series of articles looking at the tight linkages between the chemical industry and the Bush administration. And it turns out that for the allegedly objective FDA assessment of BPA, the government under George Bush literally cut and pasted paragraphs out of chemical industry memos into the government's own documents.
I mean, if we are all so exposed to these chemicals on a daily basis without even knowing about it, you know, I'm drinking a cup of tea as we speak, and there might be something in this mug that I don't know about. I mean, if they are all around us, what options do we have?
Yeah, we were very conscious of that when we wrote the book. And so the positive story of what we saw during our experimentation is that levels of pollution in our bodies responded to predictable things. So when we used a brand of shampoo that contained phthalates, there was a measurable increase in phthalates. But then when we used a brand that didn't contain phthalates, those levels came down. So the good news here is that in a relatively short period of time, if people are a little bit careful about what they buy, if they're a little bit better about reading labels, they can dramatically lower their levels of these pollutants, even in the absence at the moment of adequate government regulation.
That's Rick Smith. He's the author of the book Slow Death by Rubber Duck, The Secret Danger of Everyday Things. Rick Smith, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You're hearing the private recordings of Al-Qaeda terrorists. This audio comes from a huge cache of cassettes handed over to CNN shortly after the September 11th attacks. In this clip, we hear an operative named Abu Hamza. And at first listen, it seems like he's struggling with a bulky piece of weaponry, trying to figure out how to operate it. Except Abu Hamza isn't talking about bombs. He's talking about breakfast, to be precise, how to cook eggs on a kerosene stove. This scene and hundreds more were captured on tape by Osama bin Laden and his followers in the years leading up to the 9/11 attacks. After the FBI decided the material wasn't useful in tracking terrorists, the tapes were made available to scholars, including one named Flag Miller. He's a professor of religious studies at UC Davis, and he's spent several years listening to these tapes. And Flag Miller is with me. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Okay, we just heard the sound of a group of Islamic militants, you know, maybe somewhere in the mountains of Afghanistan. We don't really know where. They're cooking eggs. Not really something we often think about, but, I mean, you know, I guess terrorists have to eat breakfast, too. So what did you think when you first heard this tape?
Well, this is part of the magic of the audio cassette. It can be used by anyone, anywhere. And we get sounds in this collection that we have never heard before from Al-Qaeda's top operatives or average guys who just happen to be nearby.
Now, we're going to hear several clips that you brought with you, Professor Miller, but I want to talk about this one for a moment. It was recorded at a wedding of one of Osama bin Laden's bodyguards. Bin Laden was actually there. And this guy that we're about to hear, he's a kind of a master of ceremonies. He sort of holds forth. Let's hear it for a moment. Now, Flag Miller, according to your translation, this guy is ribbing the groom about looking so stiff, as if he's balancing a heavy sword on his shoulders. And then he jokes about how the fighters who come out of one of bin Laden's camps are so grim, they never even laugh at all. This isn't Henny Youngman, but, you know, the guy seems to know his audience.
He does. You know, he's aware that these folks have traveled from around the world for this great combat. They want to hear about the glories of jihad. But he also knows they also are here to party, basically, at a wedding. And the question is, so how does he wed, you know, this visions of violence with love? And he begins with a very simple observation. You know, at typical weddings, grooms are a little nervous. They can be kind of overly serious because this is a big event. And, you know, jihadis have the same kind of serious face. But in fact, jihadis can laugh. And he's talking about, you know, they've come together and they've got this big mission, but they can also join together. They're not the monstrous, vicious, bloodthirsty killers people think they are. They're good and generous people and so forth. And it may be a hard sell, but this is part of the role he has of making levity of this very, you know, serious combat front.
So we've been talking about these weirdly normal moments, but a lot of these recordings are actually calls to violence, including this one, which many of the folks listening to our conversation now may have heard. This is Osama bin Laden's 1996 declaration of war against America and the Crusaders and so on. Okay, Flag Miller, you are a scholar, an Arabic speaker. You say there's something here that many, many translators aren't getting at. What is that?
Well, the last third of this very important speech features 12 poems. In most translations of this, drop out the last third. People don't know what to make of the poetry. It's been poorly translated for one, so that makes it difficult. But to my mind, this is where he really crafts his vision for himself as a cosmic warrior who transcends specific places, times. He's able to kind of combat the entirety of the West. And he does it in the last third through poetry. And it's in direct address to William Perry, the former Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration. And it's this man-to-man combat, and he says, you know, tomorrow, William, you will discover which young man will confront your brothers who've been deceived by their own leaders.
I mean, if I was a literary critic, I might say that sounds like a bunch of self-indulgent claptrap.
This is the role of poetry, is to emphasize the kind of bravado, the hubris of the human being and taking on the world, you know, and it's a kind of register that one doesn't find in other speeches, but is nevertheless, I think, key to kind of understanding how bin Laden does come to fill the shoes of those he too dreams about.
Now, CNN acquired these tapes in Kandahar in 2001. They turned them over to the FBI, and the FBI basically decided that they were of historical interest only, that they really couldn't learn anything about terror plots. What do you think we can learn from these tapes? I mean, based on your description, it seems as if the people talking on these tapes believe that what they're doing is perfectly normal and reasonable. What should we glean from what they're saying?
Oftentimes, to take bin Laden, for example, the messages, the speeches we get from him have been officially released Al-Qaeda sponsored speeches. They're very well crafted and tailored. What we get on audio cassette is a far more impromptu soundscape of these folks in action as human beings trying to patch together what is clearly a kind of fraught argument that is worldwide jihad. And I think that these tapes offer a lot for us to understand what are the intellectual resources these folks come up with to really try to breach the gaps in their own arguments.
That's Flagg Miller. He's a professor of religious studies at UC Davis, and he's now writing a book about those Al-Qaeda tapes. Professor Miller, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.